Welcome to Chatter on Books. I'm your announcer, Jamie McIntyre. We attempted to come up with a creative introduction to the show, but our writers are on strike. Your story, Claude.
Thanks, Claude, and welcome back, everybody. It is Chatter on Books. We are very happily coming to you this evening from the McDonough School of Business, room 350, Peter, room 350. We got the emails. Michael Kornheiser, David Aldridge, Claude Jennings doing all the important work here, Chris helping us out with the video. This is very exciting. Thank you, Chris. And we've got a lot on tap this evening. We've got a couple emails which are directed to Michael. Michael's going to do the lightning round virtual book club, Stations 11. Is anybody here? We've got students here. Anybody read Stations 11?
None.
It's very timely.
It's very timely. You'll be even more scared after you listen to this. We're going to talk to Peter a little bit about this, about what it is like teaching ethics to students, both undergrad and MBA. And he has his own book we want to talk about. And then something that I've been working at for over a year, our featured author is John Carreyrou, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. We've had Pulitzer Prize winners before. David Marinus?
Did he? Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
But
okay. We're
looking for the triple. And John's had an amazing career, most impressively for me and the rest of the gang. He wrote Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, which is about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. And I think, because I have a tendency to be dramatic about things, I think it's one of the greatest frauds in business ever. And I have been stalking nicely John for over a year. And about the 95th email, he finally said, oh, my God, all right, please stop.
Crazy woman.
Yeah, kind of crazy. Stalking in a very nice, very polite way. And then we got a quick deserted island. We do not have Calvert Woodley this evening because I thought it was inappropriate to bring wine on campus.
That's probably a good call.
Calvert Woodley. Are any of the students, any of you guys legal age, 21? Okay, go to Calvert Woodley. On Connecticut Avenue.
No way for us to check, so you might as well also be legal.
The best, most knowledgeable staff there. You talk to Stephen, you talk to Bill about wine, you talk to Ibrahim, who wears a jaunty beret about cheese. You are all set, but only if you're legal. So, Michael, I told you, a couple of randoms, but they're emails. And
I didn't expect this to take off in the way it did when I recommended this book.
Michael, for those of you who don't know, Michael, a couple months ago said to me, which he said a few times, and I finally listened. He goes, come on, aren't we ever going to read a book together? Because we all read different things. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, and we created the virtual book club run by Professor Kornheiser, and it is Stations 11.
Station 11, John Mandel.
Yeah, which seemed like just a fun, interesting thing a couple of months ago.
This was before a little outbreak started to creep closer and closer to home.
Yeah, so it's about plagues and horrible stuff like that, which we didn't know about. Okay, two emails.
As David coughs.
As David coughs into the elbow.
Okay, you're right. You got me.
Okay, Michael, first email. Did Michael know something we didn't? Did he start his virtual book club because he knew that fairly soon none of us will leave our houses? So we can do the show virtually.
I thought this was going to...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did not know anything.
We can still pull it
by
back.
Skype.
Exactly. Dear Michael, I long ago abandoned my neighborhood book club. Too much work and whining and not enough wine. Please tell me your virtual book club will be virtual, meaning not too much work and lots of fun.
All I ask is that you give the book a quick read. I was talking with Tori beforehand about what's great about this is you can read it on sort of the superficial, I just want to enjoy a good book level, which is what I'm hoping that you do. Or you can try and go deeper into this. If you were listening last week, I very carefully tried to avoid using words like motif and symbol as we were trying to take a look at snow that's beginning to weigh down on this world as this flu outbreak is sweeping over Canada. We now find ourselves 20 years after the outbreak. And again, I'm just going to try and open with a few framing questions for us. If you're following along, we are on page 37, and we have found ourselves following with a traveling symphony. The symphony performed music, classical, jazz, orchestral arrangements of pre-collapse pop songs, and Shakespeare. They performed more modern plays sometimes in the first few years, but what was startling, what no one would have anticipated, was that audience seemed to prefer Shakespeare to their other theatrical offerings. People want what was best about the world. And so I think you could have the same way we talked about the epigraph. Now that we find ourselves on a shrinking stage, I would have us just try and break out into groups. If, again, this is your virtual book club, you don't need to get out the cheese and
there
wine.
There are two people in the neighborhood of Somerset who are now reading it because of you. So, yeah.
So you can always start with, well, what would you perform? And again, I would start even before that going, why would you perform? If the world that you have known has completely collapsed and gone away, you have lost loved ones, you have no real career, you have no sense of belonging, why perform? And then I think you can get into that.
So, David, how would you answer that question?
You want normalcy in an upside-down, crazy world or no longer world that you recognize. You want something that you can recognize and hold on to as a remembrance of your former life.
Does that fly for you, Professor Kornheiser?
That's great. Well, and what's so great is you can continue to spiral out from here, and you can try and think, well, what is this, as you look at these characters, what does it give each different one? It's that sense of normalcy. It's the sense of community. For some, it's a sense to a world that they still remember. Because, again, some of these travelers, these troop members, know the world pre-collapse. Uh-huh. Some of them were born into this post-world. Then you can try and think about, well, why Shakespeare?
Yeah, thank you. That's always a good question to ask. And you can, always a good question.
You can try and, I think the easy answer here is you're starting to go into, well, you're seeing the real human experience as you think about what was best, but really what was real. You can also try and take a look as you're creating this new 20-year after reality. And again, we're going to start to create our own artifacts, our own sense of what normal looks like. You can start to look at, well, that Shakespeare we were holding or held in our hands was a litmus test as to what was sort of the standards, the way of life, the beliefs that Shakespeare's world might have known that was also going through a little bit of a plague themselves.
Yeah, it's very current. Okay, what do we need? What should we be thinking about for next week?
I would like to go more into some of the characters and a simple game as you look at any of these characters now that we're beginning to see them in different settings would be just a simple somebody wants but so.
Right.
So we might follow this young actress who was on that stage, who was linking together these different worlds, Kristen. Kristen wants, but so. What's going to complicate her quest, her journey? What is she trying to resolve? And again, as we spiral out, as you pull back that onion, you're going to realize it's not just one simple solution.
Mm-hmm. Great. Excellent. David, any questions about Virtual Book Club?
None.
It's just, it's a much more complex book than I thought originally. And then because I live on Google, I thought, oh, I can read a little on Google and figure this out. And it gets more complicated. And the author, to your point earlier, someone will say, oh, it's about this. You go, no, it's not about that. And she rejects that it's dystopian. Of course it's dystopian. Mm-hmm.
What's so great is Tori was that kid who immediately goes to the end of the book.
Of course.
And is like, oh, I see there's King Lear in the first page.
Of course.
So let's break down why that's important. See your background with the sisters.
Cliff's Notes was made for me.
A zero chance
was
you were
born for me.
I don't even know what Cliff's Notes are.
And it's plural. Those of us who use it a lot, it's plural. Okay. Thank you, Michael.
That's such a old reference to Cliff Notes.
It's like exactly. Term paper services.
Exactly.
You don't even know what term paper services are, do you?
Go ahead, explain.
It's when you didn't do any of the reading and you need somebody to write the paper for you, would hire people to do that.
$20-$25?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of ethics, Professor. No, this is a serious question. I feel like I actually contribute to this.
Go for it.
When I was editor of the school paper at the American University.
Go Eagles.
In 1985 and 86, we took ads for term papers that we... We took ads for term papers, and people would write letters saying, how could you do that? How can you do that? And I said, because they're giving us $400.
That is actually...
So what are the ethics of that?
Peter Jaworski, that is a great segue to Peter, our host here at Georgetown.
We went back and forth on that, by the way.
And the author of Markets Without Limits with Jay Brennan, which is a lot. There's a very provocative thesis here about when's it okay to pay for certain things and when it is not. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Peter, but explain. Okay, first of all, you've taught a lot of places. Worcester, Bowling Green, Brown.
Yeah.
You're Georgetown. What got you into teaching business and ethics?
Well, my background, I'm a philosophy PhD, and my primary interest was always ethics. And business ethics, I'm interested in the interrelationship between markets and ethics, hence the book that I wrote. So you can see, since that was my interest, I was really excited to have an opportunity to teach that here at Georgetown.
When I first got the book, and I was just kind of flipping through it, going, okay, let me get to the end, right? And read the end first. And I swear to God, the first page that popped up, okay, how many of you, these are all students of yours, I presume. How many of them, have you read this book? Just say yes. Nod your heads vigorously. Yes.
For God's sake, Lert.
I don't require, by the way, I don't require my book as a reading.
Oh, you should.
Teach another class. Yeah. Convincing lying.
So page 117 just flipped open when I was going through it. Paying students for good grades. How about that? Right? When I went back to my high school, I had a less than stellar academic career. And when I went back to my high school 20 plus years after I had kind of graduated to do a commencement address. And all the stuff that goes on before you give your boring speech that nobody wants to hear. And they have all these monetary awards now. Yeah. The kids were winning $500 for this and $1,000 for that. And the first thing I said when I stood up, I turned to the head of the school who I had known for 1,000 years. And I said, why was this not around when I was here? I would have shown up occasionally. So I mean, you talk about different students being motivated in different ways.
Yeah.
I would have been motivated by money. And is there anything wrong with that?
So, no, I think the answer is, I mean, it's the thesis of my book. I don't think there's anything the matter with using cash money as an incentive to get people to, for example, join the virtual book club or to read books.
You let people pay to be in your acknowledgments.
Yes, that was one of the, if I say so myself, one of the more clever moves.
It's very clever.
Yeah, we sold the acknowledgments. We actually, one thing you might not know is that the highest tier is called the Silvermint tier.
Named after?
Daniel Silvermint, who's a friend and a professor, and he paid to have his last name be like the highest tier that people can pay for. We also
Burger King presents.
Right.
We sold the dedication of the book as well. My friends Chris McDonald and Alexei Marcou, both of whom are business ethics professors, they purchased the dedication and they advertised the Business Ethics Journal Review, which is BEJR.com. That's for free, Chris and Alexei.
I tried to sell the naming rights to one of my kids once. Three kids, I had all three of them when I worked for the Cable TV Association. And one of our big board members was Ted Turner, who's an incredible guy. And he's one of the great showmen of all time. And he did incredible things that nobody thought could ever be done. And I got the kid tucked under my arm at some event. And he says, what's his name? And I says, you want to pay? You can name him whatever you want. I said, we'll call him TNT if you want. Right? He goes, oh, you don't want to do that. And I said, I absolutely would do that. The right amount. Okay. So do professors at Georgetown hate rate your professor, Peter?
So I do.
Okay.
I hate ratemyprofessor.com.
Yeah.
If only because it's a very small sample size, and the kinds of people that will go on and rate you are people who are either super enthusiastic about your teaching.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the audience.
Rounds of applause, please. Yeah.
They'll go on ratemyprofessor.com.
Yeah, you guys got to learn how to lie better.
No kidding.
Or people who are mad. And that's just like, that's a biased sample.
In other words, Twitter.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. It's Twitter. Yes, thank you.
Okay, well, here's one that was there recently. Professor Jaworski is a real, you guys can tell us whether or not this is accurate. Professor Jaworski is a real gem in the MSB, McDonough School of Business. He is absolutely hilarious and possibly the quirkiest guy I know. I think quirky is good. He is very passionate about his own research and spends a lot of class time talking about it. He has a PhD in philosophy, so he's not like your normal B-school prof. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I've changed my mind about Rate My Professor.
It's awesome.
I think it's terrific.
It's a cutting-edge tool.
Exactly.
I've never read a more accurate summary of my teaching.
Should there be Rate Your Students? Wouldn't that be great?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the tables would turn.
Yeah, a little payback. Okay, so you have another book underway, the working title of which is
Blood Feud.
Which is a great segue to John, who we'll bring out soon. But go ahead, tell us about it.
So the conception of it is about the fight between the blood industry and the plasma industry. So it's really interesting because both industries are necessary. Both of them are really important. And we need the medicines as well as the blood that we get from both industries in order to help save lives. But the trouble is that the plasma industry, at least the way it operates in the United States, is they have a pay-for-plasma model. They pay people to donate plasma, whereas the blood industry has a no-pay model. It's pure donations. And people in the blood industry, a lot of them think that the growth in the plasma industry in the United States is beginning to encroach on their donors. They think, and I think it's pretty reasonable, that if you had the offer of being paid to donate plasma, or you could give your blood for free, that a lot of people are going to choose the option that pays money. And so they think that, like, what happens, economists call this crowding out, the thought is that we would get fewer donations of blood. Now, I've done some research with my colleague Bill English, who is actually in the audience today, and our research suggests that there is not that effect, not in Canada and not in the United States. And in a way, that's the basis of the book. This discovery that we didn't find crowding, which both of us expected when we started looking at the research, that's led me to the belief that there isn't really a fight between the blood industry and the plasma industry, or there doesn't have to be. Instead of competition and seeing each other as rivalrous, they could regard themselves as being in a cooperative environment. So they could engage in cooperation. So I don't think there is this rivalry. There's a bigger question about the gift and market distinction. The plasma industry, since it pays for plasma donations, people consider that a kind of market or commodity model. And that's contrasted with the blood industry, where you give blood as a gift. And people tend to think that the gift and market distinction, that those two things are rivalrous as well. And what I say about the blood and the plasma industry is the same thing that I say about the gift-market distinction. Namely, there is no real distinction there. It is possible for there to be a market in gifts and gifts in markets. And I don't think people should regard those things as competitive.
I can't pretend that I understood, I'd say, half of it.
Oh.
I really did try. But it's called Markets Without Limits. It's really interesting. Yes. It's very provocative in a good way. And people should read this. And all your students should read this. Peter, thank you very much. And again, thanks for hosting us and the pizza.
Of course, my pleasure. Yes.
We'll take a break, and then we'll come back with John Carreyrou, the subject of my stalking for over a year now.
What?
This is Chatter on Books, because everyone should have a podcast. And here's your host, Victoria, or as we like to call her, Tori Clark.
Ambient noise is good. We love ambient noise. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And if I forget to say, does anybody here have any questions? Raise your hand or nod or yell, scream, we'll do it. Exactly. Anybody have a bottle of water for David? So this is Chatter on Books. We're at the McDonough School of Business, being hosted by Professor Peter Jaworski and some of his fine students. And I can just quit the show after this, because for over a year, I've been trying to get John Carreyrou on this show. And he very appropriately ignored my emails and texts and things like that. And finally, I think he just got worn down and said, okay, I'm coming to D.C. But we are thrilled to have him here. He has got this fabulous, fabulous book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. It's just a really, really fun book to read. It is an important book. It's really, really important work. I'm going to be the mom in the room and say every single one of you students studying business and ethics should read this book, because it's an incredible cautionary tale. And John, thanks for being here. Let's go back to the beginning of you. We like to get a little bit of the backstory on authors, and we've had lots of recovering lawyers. We've had a couple of aspiring astronauts. We had a clown, somebody who wanted to be a clown. What did you want to be when you were five?
When I was five, I think my mother had seeded the idea in my head that I was going to be a doctor.
At five?
I think so.
Bad mom.
Yeah.
Bad mom. Oh, really? So a little bit of health care, a little bit of medicine in your...
Right. But actually, if you want to know a little bit more about my background, I'm actually half French. My father is French, and I grew up in Paris. My mother is American. Her father was a doctor. But my father is a journalist still to this day, broadcast journalist in France. And so I marinated in journalism my whole youth, and I went to a school in France in the French public educational system in Paris, and when I finished high school and was going to go to college, I went to Duke.
We forgive you for that, by the way. That's just, I've been tracking you for a long time, and then I saw you went to Duke, and I went, oh my God, I went to State. I understand. So anyways, we overcame that because you're here. But why did you go to Duke?
Didn't we have a basketball game just last night?
What?
Yeah. Everyone feels sorry for Coach K. He's getting older.
Duke won, by the way.
He's getting older. Yeah. Why did you go to Duke?
I spent my summers on Long Island. My mother would take my sister and me back to the U.S. and to Long Island, which is where she'd grown up during the summers. And I made friends there whose parents had gone to Duke, and I think their grandparents had gone to Duke too. And they asked me whether I wanted to go on a college tour with them at the end of a summer. I think it was before senior year, and I went on a tour that actually included coming to visit Georgetown. We saw UNC as well, yeah, and UVA and Duke, and I ended up applying to both Georgetown and Duke and a couple other schools. And
did you pick Duke over Georgetown?
And I picked Duke over Georgetown.
Should we throw them out now? Just
my French father wanted me to go to Georgetown because he'd never heard of Duke. He thought it was an obscure, completely unknown school.
As it is, or as it should be.
Georgetown rang a bell with me.
Okay, but journalism wins out over medicine. And you worked for a long time for the Wall Street Journal, a lot in Europe, right? Business, politics, mm-hmm. terrorism, yep. as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Then you come back here, and you're kind of in healthcare. You're covering the business of healthcare, right?
Right. I was covering, when I first came back in 2006, I covered the pharmaceutical industry for about 18 months, and then my beat kind of expanded to healthcare writ large. And then in 2010, I joined the journal's investigative team. Because I'd been reporting for the previous, I guess, 4 years on healthcare, nothing but healthcare, I kind of kept rolling with it, and all my investigative reporting was about medicine and healthcare, which made me, you know, segging into what the book is about, the Theranos story. It gave me the right background for that story when I stumbled upon it.
And when you stumbled upon it, I'm holding up and showing everybody, this is just a small sample of a lot of the covers that Elizabeth Holmes was on. And the essence of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos was she said that her technology could do hundreds of diagnostic tests on a tiny little speck of blood. And
right from the finger.
Right from the finger. And so I came out of the tech world at the time. Everybody wanted her to succeed. And everybody was falling at her feet and saying she was wonderful and she was the next Steve Jobs, wearing the black mock turtleneck. Should have been a tip off to everybody that she was a goofball. But what was it, I think I know the answer to this question, but what did you first see, what did you first hear that made you go, maybe this isn't everything they're saying it is?
So I read a story, a long profile of her in the New Yorker magazine. And
like the Ken Auletta piece?
Right, yeah. In late 2014. And the main conceit of that piece seemed to be that this young woman had dropped out at 19 from Stanford in 2004 as a sophomore, with barely any, you know, scientific training or medical training, and that she had gone on to revolutionize this corner of medicine. And I was not a tech reporter. I was not a Silicon Valley reporter. In fact, I was based in Midtown Manhattan. And I was immediately dubious of that premise because, as I explained, I'd spent the previous 10 years writing about healthcare and medicine. And so I knew how real innovation happens in medicine, and usually it involves, you know, publishing studies with data and preferably prestigious peer-reviewed scientific publications. And Theranos had done none of that, as Ken Auletta, to his credit, pointed out in that story. So I immediately had a hunch that something was off about this. But that said, I might not have done anything with it if I hadn't gotten a tip a few weeks later from a source who was a pathologist in the Midwest, had read the very same New Yorker piece and harbored even more doubts than I did, because he obviously knew a thing or two about
he had the blog, right?
Blood
it was
diagnosis.
The pathology
yeah,
blogger,
right.
Yeah.
And he had written a skeptical item on his blog and had immediately been contacted by an Elizabeth Holmes foe who had done battle with her over a patent and who had become convinced during that patent fight that she was exaggerating, that her company was essentially a fraud. So he passed the tip on to me, and that's how I started digging. You know, it was still just almost speculation at that point, because it was a third-hand tip. It was the pathology blogger who talked to a guy who thought she was a fraud. So, I was really intrigued by it, even though it was a third-hand tip. I was really intrigued because it squared so much with my feeling, the feeling that I'd had reading that New Yorker story. And then, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to give this a few weeks. I'll dig in for a few weeks, see if I can find anything. And first and foremost, I gotta find people who have primary information, a primary source. And I was able to make contact with a primary source within about 2 weeks. And he was in a fantastic position to have known what was really going on at the company, because he had been the laboratory director of the company for almost 2 years. So he knew where all the bodies were buried. And once I got him on the phone, he was terrified because he had just left the company, was being hounded by the company's lawyers. I had to grant him confidentiality. But once I did, he clearly wanted to unburden himself, and he did. And we had this like hour-long conversation in which he gave me, you know, the essentials of the story, and that was an eye-opening and ear-opening conversation.
Yeah. As you started to dig, though, at the very time you started to dig, I'll get some of the time a little bit wrong, she was convincing big names in Silicon Valley, I would say aging names, but big names in Silicon Valley to give her money. She was convincing very famous people from the political world, again, a tip-off, to be on her board, Henry Kissinger, Jim Mattis, George Shultz. I have a really cynical theory about it, but why do you think she was tapping those kinds of people in particular? She didn't go to VCs that were funding healthcare companies.
In hindsight, I think it's evidence that this became a premeditated fraud from basically 2013 on. I don't think she dropped out of Stanford in 2004, premeditating a long con. That's not what happened. She was bright eyed and she had big ambitions, and she idolized Steve Jobs. She dropped out wanting to create a company and to be a successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur. But over the years, they kept hitting a wall with the science and the technology. And so she kept on refusing to budge in her assertions that she had made progress. And so then the gap between what she really had achieved and what the company had was huge. But you're right. I think starting in 2013, she starts assembling this board of these larger than life, personalities like George Shultz, former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, Jim Mattis, all these former cabinet members or military officials. And she also targets not the sophisticated venture funds in Silicon Valley, not the sophisticated medtech investors, but what I'll uncharitably call the dumb money billionaires and their family offices, the likes of Betsy DeVos.
People like that. She was going to Walmart and
Rupert Murdoch and, who by the way, owned the Wall Street Journal, still owns the Wall Street Journal. And these people didn't do any real due diligence to speak of. And she really targeted them. And to me, now that the trial is coming up at this summer, and she's actually going to get judged by a jury of her peers, I hope that the government, calls the jury's attention to the fact that she really targeted people. And that, because what you have to prove in a criminal case is intent. You don't.
Right.
You can't just say, "Well, this ended badly." You have to show that the protagonist at the center of the fraud intended to defraud. And I think a major sign that at that point in time, 2013 onwards, it did become a premeditated fraud is the investors she targeted and the board that she assembled.
Yeah, David and I were talking about it before the show. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, there's so many things I wanted to ask you about, but I am fascinated by, as you know, reporters, there's a difference between being skeptical and cynical, right? I mean, anybody who does this for a living, we're all skeptical about everything. The old saying is, if your mother tells you she loves you, check it out. get two sources. So you had the background that made you kind of skeptical at the beginning, right? But there were so many people that wanted this to be true, right? And so how did you kind of fight that urge to kind of be in front of the parade and say, well, I'll just give into this too, because it's easy to give into this. And I just wonder where that kind of certainty that allowed you to kind of keep going, especially when she goes to your boss and says, make him stop.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, to do what I do, investigative reporting, I think you have to be a bit of a contrarian and you have to, never really take things at face value and constantly question things. And so I've always been, somewhat like that by temperament. In this case, like I said, I had my intuition based, informed by my background. And I immediately started checking her public appearances out on YouTube. And there was something very contrived about her public persona that also, had my antennas up. And then what I did is pretty much after that first conversation, hour-long conversation with the laboratory director, I went to outside laboratory experts, not at all connected to this story, the chairs of pathology departments at various universities, mm-hmm. academic medical centers, and I started asking them, you know, about the how realistic this technology that she claimed to have created was, and you know, what the state of the art was. And I think within 5 minutes of the first phone call with one of these lab experts, I think he said to me, John, you know, I'd be less surprised if Elizabeth Holmes told us that she had traveled back in time from the 27th century than if she says that she's cracked the nut of testing capillary blood
right.
accurately. And so it didn't take, you know, me a long time after consulting experts in the field to be able to stress test the science and find out that actually what she was claiming to have done was to knowledgeable people's knowledge, you know, not really feasible.
And you talked to dozens and dozens and dozens of people, a lot of whom had worked in the company, had been bullied, had been fired, or decided they knew the con was on, they couldn't be a part of it anymore. So you did get a lot of help from those people, but they were bullied, they were harassed, they were threatened. Talk about Tyler Schultz, who in the movie that's going to be made of this is going to be one of the heroes. You'll be one of the heroes, but Tyler Schultz will be one of the heroes, who was how old when...
I see Bradley Cooper playing you, by the way.
That'd be good.
So after I talked to the laboratory director, I call Alan Beam in the book. That's a pseudonym. I'm still protecting his identity, although I expect his real name to come out at the trial because I think he'll be a key government witness. After talking to Alan Beam and talking to him several times and downloading as much as I could from him, including some documents and emails, the name of the game became corroborating this information with other people because there was no way the journal was going to allow me to publish this explosive investigative story based on one anonymous source, which is what I had at that point. So I reached out to dozens and dozens of current and ex-Theranos employees, and little by little, I managed to get a few of them to cooperate with me, and one of them was Tyler. And Tyler Schultz is the grandson of the former Secretary of State, George Schultz, who happened to be on the Theranos board. George Schultz has lived now for several decades out in Palo Alto. His house is literally on land owned by Stanford, so it's basically on the Stanford campus. He's always been, you know, fascinated by science and a proponent of science.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've watched a lot of your interviews on this. I've heard you say that, and I get it, and I kind of used to know George Schultz. He has a tattoo of a tiger on his backside, by the way. Little color commentary. But it's become part of the narrative when people talk about George Schultz in this, because he was one of the biggest perpetrators, willingly or not, of the fraud. Oh, he's passionate about science. I'm passionate about the caps. I'm not playing the first line with Ovi, right? It's kind of this convenient, right. Oh, he was passionate about science, got caught up in it. No,
he was passionate about science, I think, which made him a receptive audience for Elizabeth Holmes. Also, he was 92 years old when they met. So this is a guy who's not in the prime of his life or career anymore.
But he's in the twilight. He got his grandson the job, right? The initial job?
Essentially, he got the job. Tyler met Elizabeth at George's house. I think when he was a junior at Stanford, he first interned there that summer. Then he went back to school for his senior year and changed his major to biology because he was so taken with Theranos. Then he graduated and went to work there full time. And he spent 8 months there as a full time employee. And during those 8 months, little by little became convinced that the company was behaving unethically in a bunch of ways and that it essentially was committing fraud. And before he left, he tried to several times go to his grandfather and open his grandfather's eyes to what was going on unsuccessfully. And in the end, he had to leave the company with pretty much his grandfather, you know, siding with Elizabeth Holmes and not believing, you know, his own blood. So that was really tough. And then Tyler and I made contact a year later, and he was still struggling with all of this, and he was sort of in internal turmoil over it. And one of the things, you know, the touching things about why he became a source of mine is one of his motivations was to save his grandfather's reputation.
Yeah, he seemed to have had the best of intentions, and it was just, from the outside looking in, it was so tragic. Again, everyone should get this book, Bad Blood, by John Carreyrou. One of the most remarkable things is George Shultz, his grandfather, didn't believe him, even though he gave him chapter and verse and tried to explain to him why this isn't for real. And George Shultz lines up with her lawyers, including David Boies, one of the most intimidating lawyers out there. They ambushed this kid. He was, what, 25 years old?
Yeah.
In George Shultz's own house. Yeah. This is going to be a great scene in the movie, by the way.
They ambush him at George's house with two Boies Schiller Flexner lawyers. That's David Boies' law firm, and they were the attorneys for Theranos. And Tyler had specifically asked George to meet with him one-on-one because George had called Tyler's dad saying that the company suspected he was a source of the journals. And so Tyler had called his grandfather back saying, let's meet one-on-one. And so George had said, sure, come over. And Tyler came over. And at first, it's just George and Tyler and George's wife. But then a couple of minutes in, George says, do you mind if I ask the two Theranos lawyers waiting upstairs to come down?
Wow.
And
that makes for interesting Thanksgiving dinners.
Right.
You know?
And they came down and they you know, hounded him and harassed him, tried to get him to admit that he was a source of mine and to get him to recant what he told me and finger other sources of mine. And, you know, to Tyler's great credit, he didn't buckle that evening. He didn't buckle the next morning when they had a second meeting. And then he lawyered up and he withstood this tremendous pressure for months.
And his parents spent about $400,000 on legal fees?
Yep, more than $400,000. One of the Boies Schiller partners told his lawyer that he was going to not just bankrupt Tyler himself, but bankrupt the entire Shultz family if Tyler didn't do what they wanted them to do. So he was under tremendous pressure, this kid.
So how much of this is centered on the fact that a lot of older men with money wanted to be around a very smart, very young, very attractive woman with a very deep voice?
I mean, I think that's definitely part of it. You look at the composition of that board, mm-hmm. you know, it was all these older men in their 80s and 90s. Right. Some of them might have been in their 70s.
There were no women on the board.
There wasn't a single woman.
Zero women.
Yeah.
Not a single woman on the board. Not a single woman in the upper management of Theranos.
And some of the first skeptics were her professor at Stanford and another woman that was in the company, right?
One of the very, very first skeptics was Phyllis Gardner, who was a professor of medicine at Stanford Medical School, whom Elizabeth had gone to with her first idea, which was for this, like,
the bracelet.
Which was complete science fiction. And Phyllis tried to make her realize that, and she just brushed Phyllis on and then went on.
Kathy Bates plays Phyllis in the movie, by the way, right? Yeah, thank you.
And, so I think it was very deliberate on Elizabeth's part to target these men. And these men, you know, they fell under her charm. There weren't a lot of people in 2012, 2013, 2014, not a lot of women who were in their late 20s, attractive, smart, spending 30 hours a week with the 92, 93-year-old George Shultz and the 93-year-old Henry Kissinger. So, you know, not to suggest that anything inappropriate transpired, it's undeniable that they were flattered by the attention of this.
Plus, those and not speaking for them, but again, kind of knowing them back when, they wanted to be a part of the tech world. These guys who have been in foreign policy or national security, but no, you know, they weren't getting called a lot in those years.
They
wanted to be a part of something that was cool and hip and sexy like tech.
And more than that, they wanted the money as well. They were getting stock options as compensation for being on the board. And at the peak valuation of $10 billion, the stock options that they had were worth several million dollars each. And, you know, Henry Kissinger was going around telling people that Theranos was going to make his heirs rich. And Tyler himself suspects that his grandfather was mainly driven by greed in this situation.
Yeah. So you're always, in the many interviews I've watched, you're very careful not to label her and say, I'm not a psychiatrist, I can't tell you, is she a psychopath? Or something. But you do say, and there's an ethos in Silicon Valley, fake it till you make it. And you do say she picked the, and that it's okay if you're making a, you know, some software or you're coming up with a device because people's lives aren't being harmed. It's different in healthcare. But you do say she picked the wrong role models. Can you talk about that a little bit?
She did. I mean, she really, her biggest role model was Steve Jobs. Another one was Larry Ellison, who was an early mentor and investor in Theranos. He invested early. Both of these guys were famous for faking it until they made it in their early years. If you go back to Steve Jobs' youth, before he even founded Apple, with Wozniak, there's an anecdote where Wozniak programs a little video game, and Steve takes it to Atari and shows it to Atari, and Atari's like wowed, and they hire Steve on the spot, and he fails to mention to them that he didn't do the programming for the game. It was his buddy Woz.
Slovenly guy, right?
Right. And Larry Ellison was famous for, in the early years of Oracle, hyping, you know, the software and claiming that it had features that it didn't yet have, and for also shipping early versions of that database software that was crawling with bugs, to the point that early clients like the CIA would be calling his programmers in the Valley, and they would debug the software together. I mean, that's how bad and unreliable the Oracle software was in its early versions. And Elizabeth, she knew this culture and this lore. From the moment she got to Silicon Valley, she channeled this culture, and she felt like if these guys that she idolized had behaved that way, then surely she was entitled to as well. And the problem, as you mentioned, is that she wasn't a computer entrepreneur. She was a medical entrepreneur, even though she and Sonny like to often mention the fact that there was a software component to the device, which was mainly had to do with the user interface.
Right.
But really, it was a blood testing machine.
Right.
And she, I don't think she ever lost sight of it. I think she sort of shut out the consequences of having a blood testing machine that's not really reliable out into the world. She sort of like pushed those repercussions and consequences out of her mind and just went.
But she had gone live with this technology. It was in Walgreens.
Right.
In Arizona, people were getting results and making healthcare decisions based on
right.
results, many of which were wrong.
Right. They altogether, I think they produced over two plus years, 13 million blood test results. And after my reporting, they voided about a million. But I happen to know that the last laboratory director she hired to try to clean up the lab, after spending time looking at their operations, lobbied her to void many more, possibly every single right. blood test result that they'd ever return to a doctor and a patient, because there was zero quality control. And that last lab director felt like the company should just disown every single result, and that patients should know that none of those results had been reliable. And she didn't do that, which I think is the last crime she committed, is she didn't void as many blood test results as she should have.
So speaking of crimes, give us the legal update. Where things stand? What are the chances she's going to be wearing horizontal stripes anytime soon?
Right. So she was indicted, and Sonny, her ex-boyfriend, they were both indicted in June 2018 on 11 counts of wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud, which carry a prison sentence of 20 years if you're convicted by a jury. The trial begins the summer. Jury selection starts the last week of July, and opening arguments are set for the first week of August. And I think it's going to be a really important case. It's going to set a really important precedent for Silicon Valley, because I don't think much has changed there since this story was revealed, since the scandal was revealed and since my book came out. I think what has the potential to change things is if she goes to prison, and if she and Sonny mm-hmm. do prison time, potentially that could wake people up to the ramifications of what they did.
Can you get called in the trial?
I doubt it. Certainly not by the government, because they've since done their
right.
Thorough independent investigation. I think there's an outside chance the defense might subpoena me, in which case it would probably have to do with trying to get me to reveal.
Because even recently, she's been trying to say, she said a little bit, trying to point fingers at you, saying this is all because this journalist
right.
stirred this stuff up. Right.
In court filings, they've because they've been asking for some of my communications with the FDA and CMS, which is the other health regulator, it suggests that, one of their lines of defense is going to be there's this rabid Wall Street Journal reporter who...
You look rabid. we're trying to contain him here in business school.
Who got the rest of the media, you know, all whipped up into a frenzy and got regulators to intervene, influenced regulators inappropriately to crack down on us and that put us out of business. I think that is going to be one of their lines of defense. But I sort of doubt that I'll be subpoenaed by the defense. I think most likely the only way in which I or my book appears during the process of jury selection, I think they're going to ask every single potential juror whether they've read the book and whether they
well,
read
we hope so.
The media coverage. And of course, you know, every potential juror that says that they have will be excluded from the jury pool.
Yeah. All right, let's get you out with this. So you interviewed dozens and dozens, hundreds of people in the course of, you did 40, yeah. 50 stories for the Wall Street Journal
right.
in the book. So
yep.
easily hundreds of people?
Easily.
Easily hundreds of people.
Yep.
Thousands and thousands of documents. But you never had access to her?
No.
Ever. So here's the question. If you got 5 minutes with her and she agreed to answer one question, what's the one question you would ask her? And you can only ask one.
I think I'd use a couple of the first 5 minutes to try to break the ice with her, make small talk.
Because you want a deep, meaningful relationship with her. Yeah,
get her to warm up to me, seeing as she sees me as the Antichrist. But eventually, I think I would warm up to the question that the foremost question on my mind is going back to that 2013 period when she goes live with technology that she knows is fictitious and faulty. And so therefore she knows she's putting patients in harm's way. And then she, on the back of the commercialization of the blood tests in Walgreens stores, she goes and she raises that last enormous round of funding, which is almost $800 million. I would say, I would ask her, what was going on in your head then? How were you able to rationalize that key moment? You know, I think even most Silicon Valley entrepreneurs would have reached the edge of that precipice and said, you know, this is going a step too far, and backed away from it. And instead she plunged. And so I would want to ask her what was going through your mind and what made you cross that really bright red line that turned this into a massive fraud.
And presuming you know her better than almost anybody else, and presuming she would answer you honestly, what do you think she would say?
I think she still hasn't admitted to herself that this is a fraud. You know, she's still living, she's still reasoning that this was okay. It was okay to behave this way in Silicon Valley because we take risks. We cut corners, but it's in the name of a noble cause. We're going to change the world. They love
right.
to say that.
You know, yeah.
They're going to change the world. In this case, you know, this would have been, if this technology had been real, I think it would have changed the world in more ways and better ways than, say, Uber. But... So I think she's still reasoning this way, that the ends justify the means, and therefore it's not fraud.
Yeah. Okay, wait, I lied. Where's Peter? What was the question we'll ask on behalf of the students? The one question you said you wanted to ask John, remind me? Okay, anybody have, any of the students have questions? Pardon me? Yeah, ask it right now. We'll repeat it.
Okay, so first of all, I just want to say that your book is one of the first books I actually read from front cover to end cover.
Yay!
So mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Even after I read the book, I was like really shocked because I grew up in San Diego and I was close to the Evans family. So I was like really shocked when I found out that she married the older brother of my friend. But my question is that in terms of journalistic ethics, like I know that Tyler Schultz, I've always been curious, and let's say like an organization, they want to find out who a leader is. Why don't they, let's say they make every like a top-level employee say, you have to sign a release, sign a public release saying that I authorize any publication that releases to, if it is me that was the one who spoke to the journal, I release myself of any anonymity to it. With the Wall Street Journal, if they sign a letter saying that I want to be released from my confidentiality, I'm speaking to you, would you guys go through with that and then release their name?
So if I understood the question correctly, is why didn't a guy like Tyler Schultz get the journal to...
I'm just saying, like, if Theranos, for example, if they made, like, if you still played with them and they made everyone in the organization say, I authorize the Wall Street Journal to release my, to release me of any confidentiality if I was the one who spoke to them, would you guys go through with that?
What is your question, why did Theranos not... I'm confused.
If they did that, if they made all their employees say that I want to be released from any confidentiality.
Well, why would they do that? That went against their interests, because then that would have allowed Tyler and Erica and other sources to speak on the record with their names attached. And so then that gives even more credence to what I'm writing based on what they're saying. And, you know, one of the ways in which they attacked my first story was to say it's mostly based on anonymous sourcing. You know, it wasn't entirely based on anonymous sourcing, because I had flown to Phoenix and I talked to doctors and patients on the record about the erroneous blood tests they'd received. But in terms of the company employees, former company employees who told me about what was going on inside the company, it's true that those sources were anonymous. But one of the ways I counteracted that argument was by having a half dozen of them, and they all corroborated each other. Right. But yeah, they would have been shooting themselves in the foot if they had released Tyler and the other whistleblowers from.
They didn't sign a lot of NDAs, though, did they? With the company,
they did. As a policy, Theranos made you sign when you joined, mm-hmm. before you even became an employee, and then on your way out, they had you sign more exit papers, including more confidentiality clauses.
And even people who would just come in and visit the facility would sign NDAs when they walked in, right. just for a meeting. Mm-hmm. Right?
And they had one professor of laboratory medicine at Stanford. They brought him inside the tent around that period, 2012, 2013. Because they wanted his opinion on certain things, and before they let him inside the tent, they had him sign an NDA. So then, after he saw that they didn't have much mm-hmm. in terms of technology, he was muzzled because he had signed that NDA. And that was a big tactic. Right. They wielded NDAs very heavily,
vigorously, right in front. Go ahead.
It seemed like towards the end she was kind of trying to keep up with you, but in some aspects, she was a little bit.
I think, yeah, I know what you're referring to. So the day that my first story was published, which was the fruit of like an 8-9 month investigation, leading up to the publication of that story, I'd started hearing through the grapevine, namely through former employees, that there had been an FDA inspection. And I couldn't confirm it, namely because I had this high-ranking source at the FDA that I couldn't reach. So we went out with my story anyways, and then that morning, the day that the first story was in the paper, I tried my FDA source again and finally got him on the phone. And he confirmed to me what I'd been hearing for several weeks, which that there had been an inspection, and that during the inspection they had basically shut down their finger stick testing by taking away their proprietary little vial in which the blood prick from fingers was put. And so that effectively froze their finger stick testing. And as we always do at the journal, before I published that second day story that night, I reached out to Theranos, to Heather King, the general counselor, told her what I'd learned by email, and asked for comment, and gave them the opportunity to rebut or deny or confirm whatever they wanted. And Heather King didn't reply for hours. And then Elizabeth Holmes went on Jim Cramer's Mad Money program to rebut my initial story. And in that appearance, put in mention of the fact that they had voluntarily withdrawn their little blood vial and voluntarily stopped their finger stick testing. And so they were getting ahead of the second blow, trying to get ahead of the second blow. So when that happened, we were pretty close to publishing. We immediately put the story out within minutes. And so I don't think her gambit really worked. But I think that's what you were referring to.
Yeah. She wasn't dumb. She isn't dumb. Up here.
Great book, by the way. Can we just quickly talk about Jim Mattis and his role on the board? I felt like when I was reading the book, he was a little less devious than the other guys. Like, there was a sense that he was going to use this potentially for military use, and like some of these aspects, whereas the other guys were more for enrichment purposes. Did you get that same feeling?
Yeah, no, I think it's probably fair to say that his first communications and interactions with Elizabeth were all about bringing the technology to the military, and he really thought that this could be a game changer for troops in the war theater in Afghanistan, where he and Elizabeth were pushing to have the device tested. I think that was his main motivation at first, and then eventually I think he got caught in her web like all these other older guys did. And when he retired from the military in mid-2013, within months, he had joined her board, and he had given her the head of his security detail. I think he fell within her. He became one of her followers. But it's true that at first, I think what drew him to her and to the company was the real promise of applying this technology to the battlefield.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you talk a little bit about how you managed your own fear of retribution during this whole process?
Yeah, I mean, it was...
You were followed? They threatened you? They harassed you? They went to your bosses?
It was never clear if they followed me, but we ascertained without a doubt that they had private eyes following Erica Chung, who was one of my sources, and Tyler.
Tyler.
Mm-hmm. And then the guy who goes by Alan Beam in the book, the former laboratory director. And so I inferred that they probably had me tailed too. And so I'd come out of my apartment building in Brooklyn in the morning, and I'd like look left and right to see if I could find, you know, or spot anyone. And there was a heavy, heavy legal pressure from boys. We had that really surreal 5-hour showdown at the journal's offices described, I think, in chapter 21 of the book, where they really, you know, tried to intimidate us. And then letters that would fall from boys and from Heather King, the general counsel of Theranos, on a weekly basis, basically.
25 page letters.
Right, right. Yeah. And, and one of those, I think it was a 23 page letter from boys to the top editor at the journal, you know, pretty much trying to get the journal to disown me by, painting my reporting tactics in the darkest ways. And, Sonny, as I mentioned, flew out to Phoenix and literally threatened doctors, who spoke to me on the record, got some of them to sign prepared statements recanting what they told me. Tyler was ambushed at his house. It was like, the thought came to me at one point that I feel like I'm in a movie. And
well, you will be. Yeah. So, yeah.
And so it was stressful, but I never reached the point where I was worried for my physical safety, because I kept reminding myself, you know, I'm just reporting about business in America. It's not like I'm reporting about the narcos and the Zetas in Mexico, mm-hmm. In which case, you know, if I were, I might have more reason to worry.
Did you ever doubt?
I would put things in perspective that way.
Did you ever doubt yourself? To David's earlier point, everybody else was going the other direction
I didn't doubt myself because early on, as I said, the first real primary source I made was the lab director,
right,
who knew where all the bodies were buried. And then after the first conversation with him, I had long conversations with lab experts, unconnected to Theranos, about the feasibility of her claims. And I realized that, you know, based on what these scientists were telling me, that it wasn't possible. So I didn't really have enormous doubts ever during the 8 months that led to that first story.
Well, thank God you were intrigued. Thank God you got the tip from the blogger. Professor Jaworski, you want the last question for real?
Well, I do have a question about recognizing people who might be frauds. So for students here in the classroom and others, is there anything that gets, you said that Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes made your antennas pop up. Is there anything that should make our antennas pop up?
Black mock turtlenecks.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, so... I, even though I was based in New York and I wasn't covering Silicon Valley, I had been following what was going on in Silicon Valley through the press. And I was also old enough to have lived through a first bubble, which was the dot-com bubble in the late 90s, and saw how that ended. And so I definitely felt that things had gotten, by that point, late 2014, early 2015, frothy in Silicon Valley, and that there was a bit of a gold rush going on out there, and potentially another big bubble building. And common sense told me that usually in those situations, fraud is not far behind, because, you know, when you have these periods of excess, people start not looking at things as closely anymore, not doing their due diligence and suspending disbelief. That's when there's an opportunity for fraudsters. So I had that, those were some of the thoughts I had, but then lessons in hindsight to apply from Theranos. I think you want to be, you want to question cults of personality. Theranos and the Holmes story was a cult of personality. And there are a lot of those in Silicon Valley nowadays. You know, there's the myth of the genius startup founder who can walk on water, see around corners. We owe that myth to Steve Jobs, mainly because his career was so incredibly successful that it's popularized this notion that you can have more Steve Jobses. And Silicon Valley really believes this. You hear VCs, even still today, say, I don't invest in the company, I invest in the person. And so I would be skeptical of cults of personalities or anything that has the whiff of a cult of personality. I would look at, if we're talking about companies, I would look at the company's board, because in hindsight, that was a major red flag. All these larger than life former cabinet members and military officials, you know, A, they were old, and B, they knew nothing about medicine, much less even blood diagnostics. And, you know, come on, if you're a company that's on the cutting edge of blood diagnostics, you would want experts on your board, and that company had none. So that was another red flag. And then disclosures. Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing that and it's still going on to some extent. There was so much capital in Silicon Valley during this period from 2010 to basically now, so much private capital available that these startups were able to stay private much longer than their predecessors had. And when startups stay private, that means they don't IPO, meaning they don't their stock prices don't become publicly traded, and they don't have to undergo, you know, greater scrutiny with quarterly disclosures and annual reports and answering analyst questions and reporters' questions on conference calls. And that environment is an environment that facilitates fraud, because you can hide things a lot easier in that sort of environment. And so those are some of the things I would think about.
So what's next for you? New gig. You've got a new gig.
I have a new gig. I can't say exactly what it is, because it hasn't been announced yet. I think it'll be announced next week or the week after. But I can tell you it's in the world of podcasting.
God bless you. And everybody should have a podcast. My dog has a podcast. Everybody has a podcast.
And I can also tell you that I'll be covering Elizabeth Holmes' trial this summer in the form of a podcast.
Excellent. That'll be like, who was it used to cover? Oh, my God. He's passed away. Famous journalist. Used to go and cover the really famous trials. They were great. And you wrote for Vanity Fair.
Oh.
It'll come just at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
But do that. That'll be great. But you've got to do it like the Daily, where we get reports.
Right. So the idea is to have a couple of curtain raiser episodes in the weeks preceding the trial, and then to drop an episode once a week or once every 10 days during the trial. The trial is supposed to last about 3 months.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. So the book is Bad Blood. Several people in this room have read it. Everybody should get this book. It's a great read, as Larry King used to say. It's not just really important. It's not the greatest cautionary tale I've ever read, but it's a really, really fun, great read. And as Jeannie and I were talking earlier today, we always talk about, you know, could this be a good movie? It's been a spectacular movie. So, Professor Jaworski, thank you so much for hosting us here. Thank you, students, for letting us be here. Michael's getting antsy. He's got to get home and get somebody in the bathtub. I can tell. Claude, Chris, thank you for making everything happen. We're going to get everybody out on this, because this is a great cautionary tale, but there are others. So Deserted Island, John, I didn't give you this homework, but Deserted Island is recommend a book based on whatever we come up with. And so today it's a cautionary tale. And I'll go, no, Michael gets to go first. Do you have one?
He has to go.
Cautionary tale. Do you have one? Book or story?
Oh, this is more of a release.
Go ahead.
So Walker, my almost three-year-old, is in a huge baseball phase. So I'm looking at this as three strikes. Strike one has been sitting for a little while, but Mitchell report.
Right.
And the Manfred release on the Astros. And we're waiting. One more for strike three with the Red Sox. I was thinking about this today during his nap time, why am I watching a spring training game? But who's doing the game? A-Rod. Talking about some cautionary tales.
Very good. Okay, go. Hugs to Walker. David?
I wanted to keep it simple because I'm not very smart. And so I always think your best cautionary tales are the ones that you're told. Any grim fairy tale is a cautionary tale, right? Yeah. So I thought about two. One was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is don't be a pig.
Excellent,
and
right.
You won't drown in a lake of chocolate.
Don't be a pig, good life lesson.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other is The Emperor's New Clothes, which is extremely appropriate for these days.
Excellent. Mine's the Mueller Report, and everyone should read the Mueller Report. Care or don't care about Trump, nothing to do with that, but because of what he says about the Russians. And it's be afraid, be very, very afraid of the trouble and the mischief and the discontent and the disinformation and the screwing with our elections that they have done. So everyone should read the Mueller Report. And John, I didn't give you this homework. Do you have another cautionary tale other than your excellent book?
One of my favorite books about another con artist in recent years is called The Man in the Rockefeller Suit, written by a Vanity Fair writer, and it's about this German guy who passed himself as a Rockefeller heir for decades in this country and also, unfortunately, committed two murders. And I think if you liked Bad Blood, then you're going to love this book, The Man in the Rockefeller Suit.
Great recommendation. Thanks, everybody. Professor, again, students, thank you so much. Come back next week. We've got Tom Rosensteel, a great book. He says it's fiction, but I don't think it is. It's called Oppo, and it just nails Washington, D.C. It's about opposition research and campaigns, and it's a great way to get into the political season without talking about certain people. So thank you, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week. We're out.